Welcome to Parents' Perspective. I can't figure it out. Mona sat with her head in her hands. What is it, honey? Brad turned down the remote and looked at his wife. Darren just doesn't make any sense these days, she began, her voice quivering. He just says nonsense stuff to himself. Or maybe he's talking to the walls. I don't know. Well, maybe he's just bored, Brad offered. 7-year-olds can get bored, you know. I know, but he just seems to want to stay in his room. He never wants to play with any of the neighborhood kids anymore. He's becoming weird. You think he's been bullied or something? Brad ventured. I don't think so, Mona replied. But he just seems to be in another world. He laughs at things that are so strange, Mona sighed. It's really creeping me out. She looked at her husband and bit her lip. What if there's something truly wrong? What are we supposed to do? From a parent's perspective, what should we know about early onset psychosis? I'm Sandy Burt. Linda Perlis couldn't be with us today. She'll join us again on our next show. Our guest today is an expert on this subject. Dr. Nitin Gogte is a staff physician at the National Institute of Mental Health in the Child Psychiatry Branch. His current focus is on the Childhood Onset Schizophrenia Project. Dr. Gogte's primary interest is studying normal and abnormal brain development, along with the clinical issues and neurobiology of childhood onset psychotic disorders. He has one son, age 12. We're glad you can be with us, Dr. Gogte.
Thank you for having me on.
How is childhood onset psychosis usually misunderstood by the general public?
It's not unusual for young children to hear voices. And the common mistake that parents or anybody makes is that hearing voices means that they could be suffering from some serious mental illness like schizophrenia. Schizophrenia in children is extraordinarily rare. I mean, schizophrenia in adults is about 1% the incidence, so it's not that uncommon an illness in adults. But when it happens in children, it is extraordinarily rare. We think that the incidence is somewhere between 1 in 30 to 50,000. So it's fortunately a very rare illness, and that's why it's important not to panic and not to jump to the conclusion that the child could be suffering from something as serious as schizophrenia. There are more and more studies that show that healthy, absolutely fine children hear voices. And they're relatively more common before they are school age, like 6 years old.
Is this in the same category as we would call an imaginary friend?
And that becomes a little tricky in children because kids do have imaginations and they have imaginary friends and they actually even make a whole imaginary stories and they create characters and all of that. That also is part of the healthy development. But it's in addition to that, actual true hallucinations. I mean, hearing voices, those experiences are not that rare in healthy children.
Why is that? Is it a chemical thing that goes on as the brain develops?
We do not know the exact mechanism, but it probably is the part and parcel of the healthy brain development. And actually, even in adults, in certain situations, it's not unusual for adults to hear voices. There's one typical example that is when, for instance, people are falling asleep and they are in that twilight zone. Between awake and falling asleep, sometimes you hear noises or sounds or voices. Those are called as hypnagogic phenomena. And those are well-documented, absolutely normal occurrences. And this happens probably even slightly more commonly in children as they're growing older and as their brains are maturing and as they're developing. Some studies report incidents as high as 15 to 20% of the kids that can hear voices or experience what can be described as hallucinatory phenomena. In addition to this, there is a lot of other causes why children would hear voices. Sometimes even over-the-counter medicines like Benadryl. If you have given your child Benadryl for allergy or something else, that can sometimes make them hallucinate.
Now, is this the kind of thing where it would be considerably after the taking of the medicine? Could it be days after? It would be just 24
it's
hours
It's usually
after?
Within a short period of time. So I would say within hours or so. But depends on how long the medicine sort of has an effect on the child. So different medicines could be one reason. Sometimes even stress and anxiety can make children hear voices or experience these phenomena. For instance, kids, when they get stressed out, nervous, anxious, they can experience hearing voices. So, and these are all within the realm of nothing majorly wrong going on with the child, so to say. So it doesn't mean that they have some serious mental illness immediately.
I've also read that behavior that would be normal at one age could be abnormal at another age.
Mm-hmm.
So does it mean that we have to sort of know what's normal development for each age and stage before we freak out?
Yes. And as I said, I mean, up to age 5 or 6, hallucinatory phenomena in children tend to be more on the realm of normal childhood development. I mean, they should not be very frequent and they shouldn't be happening all the time and every day. So it also depends on how frequently the child is experiencing this, how much it is affecting the child's day-to-day life. And those are the factors that are more important in examining or evaluating the hallucinations in children or psychosis in children.
Is this also this wavy line between reality and fantasy that children, when they're younger, sometimes cross? It's not clear.
Absolutely. And a lot of times, kids are very impressionable. And what happens is, with children, it is always tricky to evaluate it because it could be that they're just taking their imaginary world a little bit more seriously and expressing that to the parent that, look, this friend I'm talking to, or this is the game we are playing in this whole imaginary world. And it doesn't necessarily mean that they're truly experiencing hallucinations.
That's just sort of like at the birthday party when one child roars and says, I'm a lion, and so forth. There could be one child
Absolutely. Who
actually believes this child's turning into a lion.
Absolutely. And that's likely to be more common in children. So I think it's very important to take that into stride and observe these children a little bit more carefully, rather than panicking about it and immediately thinking that something is wrong with the child. It also sometimes, you know, kids, they're in the classrooms, they're in the playgroups, they hear things, they hear stories, they create stories amongst each other. Sometimes they come home and talk about those things. And some kids talk as if those are very real. It's important for the parents not to overreact and not to overinterpret things sometimes.
So would you say that's the most important thing for parents to remember?
Absolutely.
Don't overreact, pay attention.
Absolutely. Pay attention, talk to the child, don't overreact, and don't panic.
We'll take a short break now and be right back to continue our discussion on early onset psychosis.
The popular new book, Raising a Successful Child, Discover and Nurture Your Child's Talents, by Sandra Burt and Linda Perlis, is available at all major bookstores and on the web.
Welcome back to Parents Perspective. We are talking with Dr. Nitin Gokhte about childhood onset psychosis. So if it looks like, after trying not to overreact and not to panic, that this is not normal stuff, what's the next step? What should parents do?
I think the next step is then at that stage, I mean, a couple of things to think about is whether how frequently is the child experiencing this, for instance. Is it happening every day? Is it happening multiple times a day? If this is happening constantly or more frequently than it seems like it's part of a gameplay, then I think parents need to pay attention to it a little bit more carefully. And I would suggest to get the child evaluated. First, I think most parents first go to the pediatricians, which is fine. And in most cases, the pediatricians might be able to answer or reassure them and so on, whether this looks like something serious or this is something they should just wait and watch or this is something they don't need to worry about, whether the child had any medications or whether the child had any fever or something going on. And so all those things, once they are ruled out, I think if it still remains a concern, then I think it would be very helpful to go and see a child psychiatrist and get them to talk with the child, talk with the parents, and see what's going on and evaluate it a little bit more thoroughly.
Suppose, as can happen, the pediatrician says, oh, this is nothing, don't worry about it. And it looks to the parent like it's something to worry about. Should the parent just on his own or her own find
sure.
a child psychiatrist?
Absolutely. I think if it depends on the area where you're living, the resources and especially psychiatric resources vary quite a bit depending on where you are. If you're in the rural areas, sometimes it's not possible to find a child psychiatrist or even a psychiatrist within miles. But most areas, I would say, would have at least a general psychiatrist, if not a child psychiatrist.
Would you go, like, to a university health center first?
If there are university health centers, I wouldn't necessarily say you have to go to a university health center or a tertiary care clinic. If there is a child psychiatrist, I mean, if they're friends and their pediatrician might know a child psychiatrist or other family doctor might know a child psychiatrist or a psychiatrist in the area, and if they cannot find easily, then it's always safer to go to a university place because those tend to be teaching hospitals and they are more aware of these, the academic issues or the perspectives involved in this.
Are conditions such as this early onset psychosis dangerous for anybody, for the child, for the playmates?
They're dangerous from the standpoint of unpredictability of the child's behavior. Children, when they are more seriously affected by mental illnesses like childhood onset schizophrenia or childhood onset psychosis, the hallucinations can be quite profound. For instance, a lot of children that we see at NIH, I would say an average child that comes to us is probably hallucinating about 90% of the time they are awake. So they are extraordinarily severely affected by these voices and hallucinatory experiences.
Is this the kind of thing that, all right, 90% is huge. Could a child start at 20%
yes.
and then go to 40%?
Absolutely.
And so forth? Okay.
Most of the cases, it starts very slowly and it becomes more and more intense as the time goes by. And usually, in our experience, within 6 months to a year, things start to progress quite noticeably to the point that the parents are extremely worried. They've already been to the pediatrician, to the child psychiatrist. And the cases that we see at NIH are probably at the more severe end of the spectrum because these are the families who have typically explored and tried everything in their communities and things are not working. And that's why they get referred to the NIH.
National Institutes of Mental Health is part
of
the National Institute of Health.
That is correct.
In the Washington, D.C. area.
That's correct.
And so people come from other areas of the country?
We get referrals from all over the country and actually everywhere from in North America. And our program is very unique in that once the child is referred, we obtain all the information that we can on the child, right, from the educational reports, birth records. We go through very careful evaluation of that. And if we think that the child could really be suffering from some serious form of childhood psychosis like schizophrenia, we actually bring the entire family to NIH. And we pay
siblings and everything?
Yes, all full siblings, parents, as well as the child. And we, of course, pay for the entire travel cost and everything. And once we bring the child and the family, we go through what we call is a very thorough diagnostic evaluation. And that's our whole team with two or three child psychiatrists and the social workers and psychologists and the nurses on the ward. We sit down together with the child and the parents and we go through a very detailed interview, right, dating right all the way back to the birth of the child, going up to the current day functioning of the child. So it's a process that takes somewhere between 8 to 10 hours, and we go through a lot of details. And at the end of the day, if we feel that the child could indeed have psychosis or severe illness like schizophrenia, we then offer them admission at the NIMH. We have an inpatient psychiatric ward. So we then bring the family, we admit the child, the parents are allowed, or if they prefer, they can stay at the NIH, we have a beautiful facility called Children's Inn. And they can choose to stay there, but it depends on their day-to-day lives because there are other siblings in the house, they have jobs and so on. So if they cannot stay, then we offer to pay them to visit every 2 weeks so that and they stay in close contact with their child. So, for instance, we encourage that they talk to the child every day. So then the child is admitted on the ward. And one thing that we do that is very unusual, and I think it highlights what I was saying earlier, is that we, in the first 2 to 3 weeks, we just spend a lot of time with the child. We go through all thorough examination, neurological, medical exam, just to make sure there is no other cause for psychosis.
Is this a situation where there's one clinician that's kind of connected with the child, so it's not a parade of strange people coming in and out?
That's right. No. I mean, our ward is, again, very unusual. This is not something that's common on the outside. We have a ward with 2 or 3 children, and at any given time, I would say there's at least 3 or 4 nurses, so which is very unusual. So the child gets almost one-on-one attention. We have a school right on the ward, and with 2 master's level teachers. And they actually communicate with the child's school wherever they are, and they design a curriculum that the child will follow while they are at NIH.
We'll take a short break now and be right back to finish our discussion on early onset psychosis. For an audio CD of any parent's perspective show, send a check or money order for $15 with your name, mailing address, and phone number to Parents Perspective, P.O. Box 42283, Washington, D.C. 20015. Welcome back to Parents Perspective. We are talking with Dr. Nitin Gokhte about childhood onset psychosis. What ages are we talking about? Because I'm getting the sense that these are really school-age kids. We're not talking about kids who are 4 or 5 or something.
No, I think typical child that comes to us has started experiencing hallucinations around age 10. They can come to NIH after they are 13, but they have to be below 18 to be able to stay on the children's ward. So they have to be in the pediatric age range. The youngest child so far, and our study has been going on now for 20 years, the youngest we have seen is 6.5 years old. That's in 20 years of study, we could convincingly diagnose one child that early on with schizophrenia. The typical child, as I said, is somewhere between 10 and 14. And one of the things that we do at NIH, and this is also very unusual, which is almost not possible anywhere outside, is that after first 2 to 3 weeks, when we have gotten all the medical and neurological workup done, we take away all their medications systematically, all psychiatric medications, and then we observe them without any medication, sometimes up to 3-4 weeks. And even after going through an 8 hours of diagnostic interview, the kids that we suspect as having schizophrenia, when we take away their medication, we find out almost in 40% of the cases we are wrong. The child does not have schizophrenia.
Wow.
It's not unusual for us to get kids who are on 5 or 6 different medications in adult doses.
And why would they be on so many medications?
Because a lot of times nothing is working. Part of the times it is that once the child gets started on a medication, in our current system, it's very hard to take the child away from the medication. And what ends up happening is if this is not working, something else gets added or something else gets replaced.
And so it's very often interactions.
It's often interactions. It's medication side effects. Then the child gets admitted because of their behaviors or because they are being aggressive or because they are being unsafe, a lot of times for very valid reasons. But kids are very impressionable. If somebody on the ward is hearing voices, other kids feel that they can also say those things.
And this is psychiatric hospitals you're talking about.
This is psychiatric hospitalizations. Okay. It's not uncommon, for instance, for us to have seen kids who, before they come to NIH, have been admitted 20 times.
And what happens in a normal treatment program for kids like that who don't get to NIH?
It again varies. I mean, if it's just mild symptoms, it might be that the psychiatrist or the child psychiatrist or pediatrician just reassures the parents. and the symptoms disappear. It also could be that the child gets involved in individual therapy and learns how to cope with stressors and anxiety. Then there is probably another group in whom a tiny dose of medicine, whether it is anti-anxiety medicine, whether it is a small dose of antidepressant medicine, and this will become clearer once the child is seen by either by a pediatrician or a psychiatrist. And if the psychiatrist, let's say, thinks that this is not really psychosis I need to worry about, this child has more anxiety than anything else. And if they treat the anxiety effectively, these hallucinatory experiences just disappear and they go away.
So the common response to treatment very often is after a while, things get better.
More often than not, things get better and things improve. And I think I wouldn't jump immediately to medications as well. And it might be just that the individual therapy, behavior modifications, or just learning how to cope with anxieties and stress. So a good dialogue with a professional provider would go a long way.
How would you tell an affected child, we're now going to go get you evaluated, you know, who's already clearly stressed out and maybe not exactly getting things straight to begin with?
I always say that be very open and be very honest and open with your child. Kids are extraordinarily perceptive. Kids are usually aware of these things, that something is wrong with them. So I think the first step would be to have open communication, a fair and frank dialogue with your child goes a long way. It also makes them feel okay that the parents are trying to understand me, they are on my side, nobody is just going to take me lightly, they're concerned about what is concerning me. And I think if the parents are concerned that this behavior is beyond the realm of normalcy and it's clearly affecting the child's functioning. For instance, I remember one child, the first concern that the parents ever had was when the child got a B in math. He was 3 grades ahead always than his classroom. And these are highly educated parents. And we see parents from all spectra of life. And this turned out to be a real concern because soon it progressed to him wandering around in school, being in the locker room, looking completely lost, talking to things that are not around. This child had an IQ of 140 before he got sick, and by the time he came to NIH, he could hardly tell us what his name was. And he was constantly hearing voices, and the voices were threatening him that if he talked to the doctors, something terrible would happen to his parents. The child was extremely terrified of talking about anything. So he just would not talk to anybody. And it took us a long time to sort of get to know him and get him to open and feel safe on the ward. But my point is, again, the parents got the right attention because they started seeing the decline in functioning of the child. The things that he was interested in, he stopped being interested in. He couldn't go to school. He couldn't stay in the classroom. He could not focus or do any of his homework.
And they were open with him about
their
concerns and told him that they were going to get him help in order to bring him back to normal functioning.
Absolutely. Not only that, now let's say if they do find out that the illness is something to be concerned about and the child could be suffering from psychosis, I think it's most important to educate yourself, be very reassuring to your child, but at the same time understand and hear their concerns, and also make sure that you educate your networks around you, whether it is your friends, whether it's your family, because it's very common for these kids to feel and get stigmatized because their behaviors start looking very unusual very rapidly. And what happens then, they get teased, then kids don't invite them for play dates, and they get sort of more and more isolated. And I think once the diagnosis becomes clearer and clearer, I think it's what we have seen is kids where parents follow the path of education and knowledge and sort of educating everybody in their little local community of social networks, those kids tend to do much better in the longer run because they feel more supported.
What is the outlook for kids who are diagnosed with this and then go into treatment?
Childhood onset schizophrenia, per se, the outlook is guarded. It's a very severe illness. We think it's probably like 15, 20 times more severe than schizophrenia that happens in adult, typically in adult late teens or early 20s, which is the typical age of onset for schizophrenia. So childhood schizophrenia tends to be extremely severe. And unfortunately, the prognosis or outcome is guarded, meaning they will respond to medications, but a lot of times there is minimal response. A lot of times kids will continue to be symptomatic and they'll continue to need a lot of assistance, a lot of accommodations, and a lot of help.
Is this lifelong or is it through adolescence?
No, it is a lifelong illness, unfortunately. And the child will need to be on medicines for the foreseeable future.
What resources would you suggest, Dr. Gokhte, that parents could avail themselves of?
They could start with the NIH website, the NIMH. It could be NIH.gov. They can also try NIMH.gov. Second, a great resource is NAMI, National Alliance for Mental Illness. The third resource is actually some of the childhood schizophrenia families that have been through NIH study have started a website. It's called NAS, N as in Nancy, A as in Apple, S as in Sam, that's Childhood Onset Schizophrenia, NAS.com.
Dr. Nitin Gokhte, we are very glad that you could be with us today and help us to understand a little better early onset psychosis.
Thank you for having me on the program.
Our gift for our first caller is an autographed copy of The Little Book, a collection of stories and articles, parenting tips and resources for all parents and caregivers, especially those who love and care for children and teens with special needs. Just call us toll-free at 1-800-791-8573 with your name and mailing address. That's 1-800-791-8573 with your name and mailing address, and mention show number 471. Please spell anything that's not obvious and tell us, if you can, what station you're tuning into. Visit our website, www.parentsperspective.org, where you can even listen to a show of your choice, or check us out on our Facebook page at facebook.com/Parents Perspective. This is Sandy Burt. We're glad you could share Parents Perspective. Today's program was made possible with generous support from the SF Foundation. Our sound engineer is Mark Vitelli. Music for this program was composed and performed by Jonathan Burt.